Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows. This is Scott Keith. I'm joined again today by Dr. Rod Rosenblatt and Dr. Adam Francisco. Caleb is out again, so we recorded two episodes in a day. He's still out. We are continuing our walk through the Reformation. We left off last episode at about 1534. So we'll pick up today at the events that begin right around 1535. Want to remind you again that the Thinking Fellows podcast is a podcast within the 1517 podcast network. If you'd like to find out more about 1517, please head on over to 1517.org. That's 1517.org. There you can find out all about all of our podcasts on the network, all of our blogs, the publishing house, everything going on with our speakers bureau and conferences, and also where to donate and support 1517 if you'd like to do that. Again, that's 1517.org, 1517.org. Okay. So, Adam, you were asking at the break, we're picking up in 1535, if this is when Luther begins his major series on Genesis, lecture series on Genesis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I believe it is, which is kind of funny that you asked that, because I also said at the break that I've been driving, or maybe at the end of the last episode, that I've been driving a lot, and that I've been listening to the 40 Minutes in the Old Testament episode on Genesis, and Chad Bird, who does most of the heavy lifting on that show, Dan Price is there, and Dan says he does color commentary, which is funny because he kind of does.
Okay.
But Chad's been doing most of the heavy lifting and the teaching on there, and he time and time again is referring to Luther's lectures on Genesis as sort of the first major commentary series written, or commentary written on Genesis that pulls Christ out of every verse of the Old Testament.
I remember I had never met Chad, and I was back at that January thing at Fort Wayne, and I was talking, there was a Reformed speaker I knew, and we were talking quietly in the background because it was in this gigantic gym, and Jumbotron's displaying the speaker, so it wasn't a problem. You could speak quietly and not bother anybody, and I was back there talking with my friend, and still it was going into my ears. Chad was up in the front, and I finally said, "Who is that guy?" He said, "You wouldn't have heard of him. His name's Chad Bird." I said, "Does he do this weekly in class?" He said, "Yes, he does." Mm. And I thought, "Holy smokes, where did you find him?"
Mm. He's a poet.
Was he there when you were there?
Well. No, he just left, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the year prior.
I was never sure on that. Yeah, I call him sometimes the Lutheran C.S. Lewis with how he writes. He writes in that same style.
Yeah.
Always proper English.
Yeah.
Not really sort of at the low level, but at a poetic level that every common man could understand.
Yeah. A simplicity of language done well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's one of those authors you wish you could imitate in terms of the...
He is. Yeah, I know. He is.
Imitate or eliminate. No, imitate.
try on our podcast network, try listening to anything Chad does or read any blog he writes, and you'll say, boy, this is a cut above.
Well, I started that. And that's 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, by the way, for the listeners. You can find that at the 1517 Podcast Network, too. I started listening to it, and it's back from 2015, so they've been doing it for a while. 4 years, and they're just on Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? I can't decide if it's great or if it drives me crazy.
It's great.
It's great. No, it really is. The other fun thing that's not even on the timeline that Caleb sent me to use... is that 1535 is the year that Melanchthon doubles down, I'd say, on his book that we've talked about several times before, the Loci Communis, the Common Topics of Theology. And this is the year that really gets him into some trouble. And in a lot of ways, this is a jumping off year for several kind of controversies that are bubbling up in the Lutheran church at this time, based on some of what Melanchthon writes in that 1535 Loci. This is when, if any of the listeners have, you know, maybe even in their seminary education, read anything from Bente that called Melanchthon a synergist, somebody who taught that we have to cooperate in our own salvation. This is the year that brings about all of those claims against him, when he says things like, good works are necessary to salvation.
And, yep.
Man's will participates in his own conversion.
Yep.
And things like that. That it's. I always think it's hilarious because in our day, you say that kind of thing and people are like, oh, yeah, I can see how that's the case. And back in his time, and even, I mean, in Lutheranism from his time until just some year, few years ago, this was these were very controversial things to say.
Absolutely.
Things that one ought not say.
Yep.
And
he was under political pressure at the time he did that. Wasn't that part of the small caldic, what preceded the small caldic wars?
Yeah, I mean, he's very much, it's interesting. He dedicates that 1535 Loci to Henry VIII, first of all. I mean, that's some, we just talked about Henry VIII in the last episode. So 1534, I think it was, Henry VIII declares himself as head of the Church of England. It's 34, 1535, Melanchthon dedicates this to him. And I don't, it's hard for us to place into context how important this book was to not just the theological movements of the time, but was at the time period. I mean, this is the major event going on in Christendom. These are the you know, even as Adam said last time around, even the Turks are recognizing that what's going on in Wittenberg is changing the face of Christendom enough that now might be the time to attack, right? Because they're split. And this book is what is being used to teach teachers and pastors as they go out into the world and fulfill their vocation.
There hadn't been a systematics like it since Aquinas.
Yeah. And when he changes it, this is substantial. And if he dedicates it to somebody, this is substantial. I mean, Henry gives Melanchthon a year's salary just for the letter, the dedicatory letter that dedicates it to him. Gives him 500 gulden. Gulden, is that how you say that, Adam?
Gulden.
And so this is a big deal. And the fact that he kind of went off the rails a little bit on this or was perceived to have is a big deal too. Now, I'd argue that it more than him making political concessions in here, he's just relying on Aristotle too much and people just don't get what he's doing enough. So we do that a little bit in our time too, I think. Anyway, that's going on during this time. Calvin, this is the year that Calvin publishes the, or 1536. Well, that's the thinking dog giving her opinion. that's the year that Calvin publishes the first edition of the Institutes.
Which was very small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a catechism initially,
yep.
Correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
It grew into a massive. If you want to say Protestant books, it'll be right at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And Calvin made the remark one time, I don't think that I've ever changed my mind on a substantial theological subject. And if you look from the time he was drawn to Luther to the latest edition of the Institutes, that looks like it's true. Mm. He saw it from the very beginnings where he was going, and it didn't change. Mm.
And another thing with him is, in reading Calvin, he never repeats himself.
No. I remember.
Unlike Luther.
I sat under Dick Muller, Richard Muller, the famed historian, and with several beers under our belts, he explained how Calvin did that. And in particular issues of the Institutes, you could cross the Institutes with his commentaries and that edition would help you to do it. Mm-hmm. So that you never had to write something twice. But you have to have that edition of the Institutes, and it's not the most common one.
One of these days I'm going to take you to Grand Rapids with me so that you can introduce me to Richard Muller. Because his work, I think, is phenomenal. But if the only thing he had ever done was that...
Introduction to Latin and
Greek theological terms.
Yep.
That I've given to countless students who cannot read Latin or Greek.
Yep.
To just help them wade through.
Yep.
Some of the common ideas, you know, theological ideas as they're presented in Latin and German.
Yep.
It's phenomenal. I mean, I can't.
Yep.
It's one of the most helpful things for students.
Absolutely.
I mean, so many students. We're on a bit of a tangent, but so many students these days who even go into master's programs don't read the languages.
Yep.
And they get stuck quickly.
Yep.
And his work is exceptionally helpful there. So
he's got a, since we're on this tangent, he's got a book called The Unaccommodated Calvin.
It's amazing.
Yes.
It's great.
It's, I mean, there's often this distinction maybe between Calvin and Calvinism.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the book to get to, you know, the heart of that particular controversy.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And he's an awesome writer.
Oh.
The footnotes are worth every
yep.
He's kind cent of, he kind of reminds me of like the Robert Kolb of Calvinism.
He is.
Yeah.
Not a doubt about it. Not a doubt about it. Did his PhD under Steinmetz at Duke. And boy, is he ever doing honor to his master.
Well, since you brought up Steinmetz and we're in this rabbit trail here, I think if I were to recommend two books on Calvin, it would be Steinmetz, Calvin in Context, and Muller, The Unaccommodated Calvin.
Mm-hmm. The one that I've always used, and I've asked Dr. Horton about this often, was Professor Strasburg, and it was called Calvin, His Life and Thought, Harper and Row, 1953. So half his biography and half his sort of topic by topic through the institutes. And it's down at the level that the commoner can read it. It's a translation from the French. But Wendell, we would say Wendell.
Francois
Wendell.
Yeah.
Calvin, His Life and Thought. I'd throw that in as...
Those are the three big ones that I'm aware of, unless something's been done in the last several years that I haven't...
There is. Dan Van Voorhis' supervisor wrote one. I can't remember his name. Is it
Yale? Oh, Pedigree.
No, the one afterwards. I don't remember the name, but it's
Yale now.
Yeah, it's more of a... of course, it's theological, but it's also sociological in the best sense of the term. It's a comprehensive one. Alistair McGrath has one too. That's, I think, pretty good. I like Alistair's
writing.
He's great.
Okay, so big thing happening now that I think in this time period that our listeners need to hear about is that this is also the time period, say 1536, 1537, 1538, where Luther is asked essentially to write what ends up being called his last theological will and testament, the small call articles. And he's supposed to write it for a meeting that happens with the Small Caldic League in 1537, right? So he's supposed to put this together. They're going to call a meeting together of the Small Caldic League, which we referred to in the last episode as this league of leaders and theologians, and then eventually, for the purpose of putting together an army that's formed in Germany, essentially. And what's happened with Luther is that his health has been on a downward spiral at this point. I mean, he suffers from, I think, gallstones, heart attacks, depression, gout.
Mm-hmm. He's pretty obese, too.
He's getting heavy. As he's married and he eats that great food of Katie's, he gets heavier and heavier, and she starts becoming a brewer and brews him up beer and gets heavier. I can relate to this. beer and food and writing don't equate to a slim and trim body. And his health goes downhill. And there's a lot of fear that he's going to die. In fact, I think 1536 or 35, he has his first heart attack. And the people are fairly convinced, especially the elector, that he's going to die. And there are still some questions, that theological questions, that were not answered by the Augsburg Confession or the Apology. And the catechisms, though they're... But the small and large catechisms, though they're in wide use at this point, they're not really the idea of some. So in right now, as of later on, 1517-7, 1578 through 1580, we get the Formula of Concord and then the Book of Concord, right, which sort of solidifies what are to be considered Lutheran quote unquote confessions and confessional documents. But this early on, that's not a thing. The recognized confession of faith is the Augsburg Confession. And so even before being known Lutherans, which was a pejorative given to the Lutherans of the time or used towards them, they're known as the Church of the Augsburg Confession in a lot of ways. That's if they want to know what are you, or we're the Church of that confession over there, the Augsburg Confession. The Apology is very much seen, even though it will be acknowledged as a confession of the Church, as a document written by Melanchthon, Even though the catechisms are in wide use for teaching purposes in the church, they're known as written by Luther. What they're looking for here is something that'll answer some of the questions that were not addressed in the Augsburg Confession, specifically some of them having to do with things like ordination. And now that we're not sort of in the lineage of the Roman Church anymore, how do we appoint, call, and ordain pastors? And they want Luther to address that. But furthermore, what they really want out of him is a sort of, what is your confession, Luther?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he's asked to put this together, mostly because people think he's going to die. Now, he lives another decade after this, of course, and so he holds on. But he does, at this point, this is when he writes the Small Call articles. And they have this gathering about the Small Caldic League. And Melanchthon is there, of course, and they get together to figure out whether or not this these small called articles that Luther wrote will be accepted or not. But something happens. Luther's supposed to be there, but he gets sick on the way. I think with gallstones. I'm not exactly 100% certain, right. But I think he gets sick with gallstones and has to stop in a city sort of outside of where the meeting's going to occur. He gets so sick that they think he's going to die on the way to this meeting, and he goes back, or his kidney stones, because he heads back, and heads back to Wittenberg, and the wagon ride is so bumpy that on the way, the bumpiness of the wagon ride helps him pass the stones, and he goes off to the side of the road, and it says he passes like something inordinate, like 8 gallons of.
I'm remembering.
Yeah.
He said it was like this euphoric experience, yeah. And the heavens opened up.
Yeah. He could see again. You know, the whole world didn't appear as yellow anymore. And, but he's not there at the meeting. And at the meeting, Melanchthon sort of does this end run around him, because Melanchthon doesn't like the document that he put together. He's got reservations about it, specifically regarding the fact that Luther sort of out of hand rejects all of the authority of the Pope and bishops at this point. Like Adam said in the last episode, he's done, right? This is when you'll start getting a lot of the language from Luther as the Pope is the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. If the listeners remember, Luther in early 1520s addresses the Pope and the papacy with quite a bit of deference still at this point, even to the point of telling the Pope that I'm sure you're getting bad counsel. That's why these things are going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case after the Augsburg Confession and the Confutation. That's certainly not the case in the mid-1530s. He's had it. He's now written On the Bondage of the Will. He's now written his catechisms. We've now had the Apology and the Augsburg Confession, and all this stuff has gone on, and he's just done. And this meeting that comes together, they're supposed to sort of ratify the Small Called Articles as a confessional document of the church, or one of the confessions. So now this church would be known as the Church of the Augsburg Confession, probably the Apology, and Luther's Confession of Faith, the Small Called Articles. And Melanchthon kind of does an in-run around him, and it's not adopted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's signed, and Melanchthon even signs it with a big reservation, you know, that has to do with, given that I'm doing this from memory, so I think it's something like, if given that the Pope and the bishops would do their jobs, I would acknowledge that they have authority, at least in temporal matters and things like that. Something to that degree. And he puts together himself another document called On the Articles of the Power and Primacy of the Pope, which is, too, it's very strongly worded against the power of the Pope and the papacy and the bishops. But he, with his ability in political wranglings, makes it so that his document is the one that's accepted as the confessional document of the church. And so at the meeting in 1537, Luther's Small Call Articles, though they're published in 1538, a year later, they're published, they're not accepted at the time. Melanchthon's On the Power and Primacy of the Pope is accepted, and sort of the church moves forward now with all of the confessional documents, with save the catechisms, which are very much accepted later, being by Melanchthon's hand. Hmm. Interesting, huh?
I've got this big grin on my face when you talk about Luther. Everything, it's over. Luther's done playing nice. I think of like some works he writes. This is a little later, but one entitled something like On the Papacy at Rome, comma, An Institution of the Devil.
Yeah.
or even better, you can get them online, but Mark Edwards, his book, Luther's Last Battles, has a whole series of woodcuts Luther had made with, images of people turning their rear ends to the Pope and passing gas or doing the number two in the papal tiara. There's one, this is my favorite one, the Pope, he's got his hand out and he's blessing something in his hand. It's a big pile of steamy poo. And it's just, it's over. He's done playing nicey-nice.
Yeah,
he's long been done, but now it's gotten polemical to the point of absurder humor.
A lot of the Reformation fights were fought via cartoons.
Yeah, yeah. And they're remarkable. I mean, the papacy was good at this, too. There's this one, the seven-headed Luther.
Uh-huh.
This body with seven heads coming off, and it's got Luther with a burger's hat on, but it's got Luther with a turban as if he's a Turk, and a Luther the peasant, and Luther.
Yeah.
Remarkable stuff. It makes for a great study of propaganda in the Reformation period.
Yeah.
Sorry for that.
No, keep going. I just think the whole story is kind of interesting because one of the most illustrative things to me of what goes on here is that this is a polemic age, period.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, we have to
always have to keep that in mind.
You have to keep that in mind. We're a nicey nice age, right? The greatest offense.
Some of us are, yeah.
The greatest offense you can give in our age is to give offense, right?
Yep.
If you're not giving offense, that's the only way to become virtuous or moral in our society, I think, at some point.
God help us.
You know, if you stand for some capital T truth and then you fight for it so much that you bring humor into it and make fun of people. And,
yep.
You know, that's the worst. But in their age, that was very common.
Sure.
And you can see this play out not only in the relationship between, say, the Lutherans and the Catholics, or Lutherans in Rome, but within Lutheranism, too. I mean, this is... Pretty soon you'll get, and already we've had the antinomian controversy. Pretty soon you'll get some of the major inter-Lutheran controversies that go on. You have this weird, I wouldn't call it a fight between Melanchthon and Luther at this meeting of the Small Colic League, but you have something going on. You know, that it's not the most polemical thing because it's a little passive-aggressive on Melanchthon's part to kind of go the way that he went, but you can see that they're really fighting to find what they think is true.
Mm-hmm.
And that even means that sometimes they disagree with one another and on points that I think we would think are the smallest of points, like the smallest of points. And that was common to them to find, I think most what you say is right, but this one little thing is wrong and thus I can't be behind it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in our day we'd say that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can't you just...
And we'd be more in line with the university in saying that than not.
Yeah.
If a guy can defend his major thesis against all comers, he's done his work.
But they're so polemical in this age that they'll split on these things that we today would think are minor.
Yep.
I mean, think of what ends up being the major split between the Gnasios, the authentic Lutherans, and the Philippists. I mean... You present some of what they're fighting over in 2019. And,
sure.
You know, and they're splitting this new church over this. They're splitting this. They've just spent 30 years fighting against Rome.
Yep.
They finally have some, I mean, post-1555, right, Adam, is at the Peace of Augsburg. They have some autonomy, especially if their prince or their ruler is Lutheran. They have some autonomy. And what do they decide to do? They decide to then split that over things that we would think are ridiculous, really. Mm-hmm. But this is the age in which they live. And so when our listeners read some of this and they see, like we mentioned in the last episode, theologians being martyred in Oxford for simply not giving in to some Roman Catholic beliefs, or they see Melanchthon kind of going behind Luther's back to make a change because Luther's not there, or they see the Gnasios against the Philippists later on. I mean, we'll get to that in the 1560s through 1570s. You know,
that'll be about 3 years from now.
Right? No, no, certainly not.
We're not 40 minutes in the Old Testament. We move a little faster.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's interesting to me. While at the same time, one of the things that I passed up here is that 1536, Norway becomes Lutheran. And so Lutheranism is spreading. And this is, we mentioned in the last episode, the Society of the founding of the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits. One of the reasons that the Jesuits are founded is because this thing is going like wildfire at this point.
Yep.
I mean, heck, it's making it to Scandinavia.
Yep.
Like, not too many years ago, these people were worshiping Thor.
Sure.
And now, you know, they're becoming Lutheran.
Yep.
I spent some time in Latvia this summer, and we visited a castle in Riga. I think we were in Riga, or outside of Riga. And it sort of told the story of sort of the conversion of the Latvian people from pagans to Roman Catholic, and then eventually to Lutheran.
Yep.
And so that's in Latvia. You know, that's kind of next to Russia.
Yep.
And I mean,
way up there, cold.
Yeah. How that happens is that they're sort of, Lutheranism is sort of making its way in at the lower levels of the church in Latvia. And the Bishop of Latvia is debating, you know, what to do. And Luther writes him a letter and says, you know what to do. You need to follow the gospel, essentially. And you need to come over. And boom, Latvia's, and sort of the bishopric of Latvia at that point is Lutheran.
Yep.
Just like that. I mean, so it's an amazing thing. And but this is why this is all coming together. This is why this timeline is so important. This is why the founding of the Jesuits is so important to the Church of Rome.
Yep.
Because this has to be countered somehow.
Yep.
And I do think it's rather brilliant because, and Adam, you can help me out with this because I don't totally know the history, but the Jesuits, they make some headway on countering the Reformation. I mean, the Reformation begins to churn, especially in like southern Germany, back to Rome, and it's the flip flopping is kind of
You wonder,
how rooted
was this stuff?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you're Lutheran, you're Roman, you're Lutheran, you're Roman, you're Calvinist. It's just this is a tumultuous era. It'd be really hard to imagine living during this time. It's kind of something that I think we don't really have a lot of context for.
Yeah. Certainly a different time. And I mean, but at the same time, things don't really change all that much because the flip-flopping is just simply what, you know, they're following what they decide is the most politically or socially advantageous at the time. You know, and it's at least in some of those territories. It's not rooted. It's not principled.
Yeah.
There's so many political, sociological, and other things playing in the background. But at least in those flip-flopping regions, you know, Germany, southern Germany, central southern Germany is just, that's their history. They're all over the map.
Yeah, back and forth,
decade you're looking at.
Yeah. 1539, first volume of Luther's collected works appears. So, I mean, that's early.
Mm-hmm, that is early.
Yeah. And it's a small collection. It's not everything. Yeah.
That finishes that first. Do you know what edition that is? Is that,
if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I'd know. I've seen it. I've used it. It's wrapped in pig skin.
It's beautiful.
It's like a dozen volumes.
Is it Leipzig?
That rings a bell, but I don't want to say on the air because I don't want to be wrong.
If it is, I own some of those. I think I own 10 out of 12.
Then it's probably Leipzig. Well, it's not the Walch.
I think it might be Leipzig.
Okay.
That's basically the 1530s, unless you got anything to add, guys.
No.
Well, I mean, there are, I mean, here in Luther's biblical commentaries, which are drawn from his lectures, you see Luther as the consummate exegete.
Well, absolutely.
Genesis and Galatians and others.
What Philip does, Luther is not known for. Mm-hmm. And he knows it. That's why he sees the Loci with such respect, because he's an exegete.
Mm-hmm. I did some work going back years ago for the doctoral thesis where I'm just looking for anything Luther says on the Turks and anything having to do with the Muslim world in the 1530s and 40s. The I remember the Genesis lectures. Not only do you see Luther becoming increasingly aware of a much bigger world, but he's also, there's sort of a, like a return of him referring to Aristotle and Plato and all the, you know, Luther kind of becomes a little more scholastic, if you will.
Yeah, they both do, actually.
Yeah, I mean, the introduction to the Genesis commentaries, he makes these comments on Aristotle. It's very clear that he's been reading Aristotle. He, of course, disagrees vehemently and sure. still has that hostility. But he makes things, in an introduction to Genesis lectures, where he says, Plato, because he probably got some stuff from Egypt, from the Hebrews, got as close as anyone who wasn't a Christian to
the doctrines
of Christianity. Just bizarre stuff.
It's like when sometimes you'll hear pastors saying that, you know, they are wary of when they do a funeral for somebody who's not a believer, preaching them into heaven after their death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get that sense in Luther and Melanchthon at this time.
Yeah,
they're trying to preach, especially Aristotle, in Melanchthon's case, especially Cicero, trying to preach them right into heaven after they're dead.
Well, even in the Genesis commentaries, he's making references to sources. You'd be like, how does he know these things? Averroes or Avicenna, Al-Farabi, these famous Muslim philosophers. Like, how did he gain access to them? Well, you know, it's the story of the Arab translation of Aristotle and all the other things.
Yep.
And they make their way into Latin through Spain and get up there. Finally, they get to Germany. And Luther's reading all this stuff. So you get the sense that Luther is becoming, he's the old prophet at Wittenberg, and he's reading, I don't know how he had the time to do it, but he's reading everything. He's got kids and he's, you know, all these controversies, but he's, not necessarily his worldview, but his awareness of a bigger world is very apparent in those lectures.
I'd be interested, because we mentioned this two episodes ago, I'd be interested to see sort of the change in Luther's approach to doing theology after he started to have kids.
That would be interesting.
Because
or after his daughter dies in his arms.
Oof. Because during this whole period that we're talking about, I haven't mentioned it, but this is when his children are being born, you know, 1529 through mid-1530s. This is when his children are being born. And this is when he's very much, he's done with the fight that would keep taking people away, right? Mm-hmm. And he's focused on what they're doing there in Wittenberg, and he does become sort of the senior scholar at the university, and they're running the Black Cloister as their family home, and they're housing students, and they're having students, and Katie's opening businesses, and this is a very interesting time in the life of Luther.
Yeah.
He's getting sick, right? He's tired.
Always sick, yeah.
Yeah.
In the Galatians commentary, I think it's in the introduction, it's in the early pages of that, he's got this comment that I always think is quite interesting from the perspective of apologetics in the Lutheran tradition, where he says something to the effect of, when you're reasoning or engaging in controversy with the Jews, the Turks, and other sectarians, whatever that means, and probably has in mind Italian Renaissance humanists who are toying with more agnostic kind of thinking. Just when you're dealing with those, you're in an entirely different area than when you're dealing with the papacy or other Christians. And so you have to be as wise and clever as a controversialist in those arenas. And the whole discussion around that particular quote is, he's not using the word apologetics, but him thinking about how do you engage this bigger world than the one that the Protestant Reformation is just sort of leaving, where it's just the controversy between the Lutherans and the other Protestants and the Catholic Church. Now it's a bigger world. The issue of the Jews in Europe will become an issue in the next decade, in the 1540s. The Turks is a constant pressing problem. Then you have the rise of, because this is the day and age of Machiavelli as well. So it's the rise of more skeptical thinking down in Italy, especially, that is, of course, acknowledges the past, Christendom and the Greco-Roman past, but now is kind of thinking about Europe as a different type of civilization than medieval Christendom. So, I mean, you get a Luther who is thinking about, you might say, thinking about the future and how are we going to deal with all the issues that affect us in the future apart from just the Catholics.
Interesting. All right.
Or so I think.
Well, we've got through from 1535 to 1539, so Adam's right. We might still be doing this in a year, but We at least did 5 years in this episode or 4 years in this episode. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us on the Thinking Fellows podcast. We're walking through Reformation history, trying to bring in more than just the Lutheran Reformation. I think we've done that a little bit. We thank you for listening, and we ask for your support to help keep this podcast going. If you'd like to go over to 1517.org, you can not only see all of our resources there, but you can see how to donate. Click that donate button, and if you're able to help us out, please do so. If not, just go on over there, check out all the resources. We have free videos, blog articles. You can check out the publishing house, the, I think, 13 podcasts on the podcast network. It's all over at 1517.org. Thanks for joining us.